Expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie doke. Welcome back to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live from our studios in Campbell Hall. And today we're going to be talking about the coverage of labor in the U.S. news media, how it takes place, why it takes place, what the implications are, and what can be done about it. And we're very fortunate to have, as our guests here, two fine experts on this subject. One, Christopher Martin, who's an associate professor at the University of Northern Illinois, and the author of a brand new book, which I've read and is outstanding, called Framed, Labor in the Corporate Media. The other guest we have is Frank Emspeck, who's been on the show before. He's a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he's been since 1991, and he's been very active with the labor movement and with labor media, and has been one of the founders and managers of the Workers Independent News Service, or WINS, which is a nationwide network of labor programming. Chris, Frank, are you there?
Yeah, we are.
Great. Wonderful to have both of you here. And it's a real pleasure to talk about this issue, which, you know, ironically gets not much coverage in the press, despite the fact that most Americans do work. And these are issues of great importance to Americans. Let's start with you, Chris Martin, if we can. Talk a little bit, if you would, about your new book, Framed, Labor in the Corporate Media. What's the basic argument of your book? What's the point you're trying to make?
Well, what I was interested in was you know, first of all, that the fact that labor doesn't get very much coverage, but I was trying to figure out, like, well, how do the commercial news media, the mainstream news media, kind of rationalize this sort of thing without looking completely biased? The media I looked at for this study, I looked at, you know, five big labor stories throughout the 1990s, and then looked at the mainstream media, so on television, ABC, CBS, and NBC nightly news programs, and then the New York Times and USA Today. And what I found out is that basically what the news media does is to take kind of an objective position, and I use objective with quotation marks around it because it's really more of a style of writing than really any kind of scientific objectivity. But what they do is try to approach labor stories not from more of an economic position, but instead they try to look at labor stories through the eyes of the consumer, and that actually is kind of a natural way of for the mainstream news media to look at things anyway, since they are by default commercial, consumer-oriented news media. So, for example, if it's one of the things I looked at was the 1993 American Airlines flight attendant strike, and there's been similar strikes like that. And transit strikes are a good example because usually what we get in that is not an explanation of why people are striking, why workers are striking, what the economic issues are, and the workplace issues. But instead we get lots of shots and interviews of people who were supposed to be somewhere else, you know, on their flight, and they're really angry and ticked off. And so then we get their kind of, you know, knee-jerk analysis of the situation, which is, you know, I'm really angry, why doesn't this strike just stop? You know, and I can understand that those people would be angry in that situation. But what the news, you know, where they're really kind of advocating their responsibility is to tell us what are the economic issues behind what's going on there. And we so often don't get that because we get this kind of consumer-oriented labor news.
Now, Chris and Frank, you can let me run this one by Frank first, because get him in on this. Now, when it takes the coverage of labor stories like strikes specifically from the vantage point of consumers, is that a neutral vantage point? Does that basically put management and labor on equal footing in sort of explanation and blame?
Generally not, because you never find out what the strike is about usually. And so people don't usually give up their income for nothing. They're certainly not giving it up to inconvenience other people. And so it's not a neutral attitude. What happens is, when it's covered from the point of view of the consumer, it's almost as if the workers are attacking the consumers in some fashion. And so you wind up with a sort of confusing situation. It's very, very difficult when you take it from that point of view to find out what the underlying causes are and what can be done to deal with them.
Now, beyond just the nature of the coverage, even before you get to the nature of the coverage, is really the amount of the coverage, how much coverage labor gets at all in the news media. What's your sense, Chris? Is there a great deal of coverage of labor issues?
Well, it really relates back to the consumer thing. I mean, if there's perceived consumer interest, and that is addressing the mainstream news audience as consumers and not citizens, then yeah, there isn't much. I mean, because what they really are looking for are those labor stories that have a consumer angle. So if you take the entire decade of the 1990s, for example, the biggest labor story by far was the one with the biggest consumer angle, and that was the Major League Baseball strike of 94 and 95, which just overwhelmed, overwhelming in terms of its amount of coverage. The example I'd like to give, if you're in central Illinois, you'd be familiar with this. For a greater part of the 90s, there was really the war zone going on there, and there were a number of companies that were being really pressed hard, or another number of workers that were being pressed hard by their companies, and one of them was the A.E. Staley Corporation, which was owned by a company out of England, actually, and there were about 700 workers there, and they were locked out, and there were ongoing strikes and actions happening in central Illinois. And that was about 700 workers. That's about the same amount of workers that were in the Major League Baseball strike. Yet on a national level, there was hardly any coverage of what was happening to the Staley workers. And ultimately, it ended up hurting them, I think, because I think it was an amazing story, and they were very brave workers. Actually, when I lived in Michigan at the time, my wife and I were even sending money to the workers to try to give them support in their fight against Staley, but it was just an overwhelming battle, and one that they really needed national support and didn't get it because no one heard about it.
Frank Emspeck, you've been a veteran activist in the labor movement and a variety of other social justice movements since the 1960s, dare I say it. Have you noticed a change in the amount or tenor of labor coverage through the course of your career? Or has it been pretty much steady?
No, I think it's a downward spiral in two different ways. One is the amount of coverage, as Chris has noted. And, of course, our measure is our news service. You know, it's on 100 stations out of thousands, and we're talking about 3 minutes a day. So, and there is no other national service that does labor so on the news for radio. So there's almost no labor coverage. But secondly, there have been whole swaths that have sort of disappeared on the networks that preceded NPR. You had the AFL-CIO sponsoring Edward P. Morgan in the news up until around 1970 or so, or 73, and that was a nightly program. It wasn't even labor, but at least labor was mentioned because it was the sponsor, and that disappeared in the early 70s and has never been replaced. So there's both a question of visibility in terms of sponsorship, there's content, and then there's just simply it isn't covered. The 30 minutes of Business Today, or whatever the NPR business show is called, never or rarely has labor spokespeople on it, and almost never takes the position, either editorially or certainly in a newscast, from the union's point of view. The story is framed, as Chris points out in his book, rather adroitly, I think, from a different perspective.
We're talking today to Chris Martin, the author of the new book, Framed, Labor in the Corporate Media, and Frank Emspeck, the founder and manager, I don't know what your official position is, Frank, with the Workers' Independent...
Executive Director.
Executive Director of the Workers' Independent News Service, a national radio, workers' radio service based out of Madison but goes nationally, today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you'd like to call in and ask a question or have a comment for Chris Martin or Frank Emspeck, the number here is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Chris, Frank says there's been a decline in the quantity and quality of labor coverage in the U.S. news media over the past few decades. What, assuming that's the case, and I think that actually the empirical evidence backs that up, what would account for that? What explains that?
Well, there are about, at major newspapers across the country, there's about 5 labor beat reporters. So you're right, and Frank's right, that's really fallen off dramatically.
To give some sense of comparison, any idea how many there were, say, 50 years ago?
I don't have an idea how many there were. A lot more. I mean, is it regular beat that was traditionally covered? And if you look at,
Most major cities.
Yeah. And if you look at, labor, or actually journalism textbooks these days, labor, if it's mentioned at all, is like a little tiny kind of subset of business coverage and the business beat. And that's actually the beat that's really grown over the past decade especially. I mean, it's all about business journalism, and business journalism by and large tends to be very much a cheerleading kind of journalism. So it's bigger and better and more buyouts, et cetera, is a good thing. And if you take that position, labor gets really kind of watered down to being more kind of a workplace issue, and even then it's not covered much at all.
Now, Frank, I know that the labor movement in the United States has really been in a downward trajectory in terms at least of membership, the percentage of the workforce that's part of organized labor. I think it was in the 30s, in the 1950s, 30-some percent of U.S. workers were part of trade unions. Today, it is down, if I'm not mistaken, in the low teens.
Correct, except in the private sector where it's now in the single digits.
Where it's now in the single digits. So I would imagine that an editor or journalist listening to this show so far or reading Chris's book would say, look, we covered labor back when people were parts of unions. But, unions basically are now pretty much a marginal, less than 10% of the workers. And there are probably more people in the Rotary or something like that. I mean, now that's an irrelevant part or largely marginal part of our culture. Labor shouldn't get that much coverage anymore. This is a rational response to the way power and works and the way our society is currently structured. How would you respond to that, Frank?
Well, I think that covering news of working people is not necessarily the same thing as covering news of working people's organizations. People who work for a living make up the vast majority of people in the country. And even if we did it on the basis of income and said people who work for a living who earn less than $70,000 a year, let's say, make up the vast majority of people in the country, so it behooves the media to cover the lives and concerns of those people from their point of view because you're covering the majority. Even if a particular organization or union is relatively small, our mission and our service is to cover workers. That's what it says, the Workers' Independent News Service. And I think that the media can do the same thing to sort of segue and say that unions equal workers and therefore the unions are marginalized, so therefore we don't have to bother. It seems to me basically excludes the vast majority of the population from serious coverage by the mass media.
Chris, go ahead, Chris.
I was going to say, just to follow up on that, there was a terrific book by Richard Freeman and Joel Rogers in 1999 called What Workers Want. What that book, one of the things that it really illustrated is that it found that 45% of employees in the U.S. want a strongly independent workplace organization. Now, I think actually the word or term labor union has kind of gone the way of the term feminism, where people kind of agree with the idea or concept, but they don't like that term because it's taken on a negative connotation. But when 45% of U.S. employees want a strong independent workplace organization, and then another 43% want an organization with at least some kind of limited independence from management, I mean, to me that says that that the idea, at least, of labor unions is a pretty strong concept still in the United States.
So here we've got a disconnect. We've got 88% by these figures of workers who want either unions, something like unions, or something independent of management to represent their interests in some capacity.
That's right.
In the workplace on one hand. Yet on the other hand, we have in the private sector under 10% of workers who actually have unions. So there's this massive disconnect. I mean, it's an enormous gulf between those two figures. How much is the fact that there is very little coverage of working people, of worker issues in the news, contribute to that gulf?
Well, it's I can give you a really interesting example. I was for my kind of follow-up project, I'm looking at Walmart and how it's covered, which is kind of a daunting project. But if you think of just one example, in 2000, in February of 2000, there was the first actual unionized group of Walmart workers in a little town called Jacksonville, Texas. And it was a small group of meat cutters. And if you remember the story, or if you even heard of the story, they actually voted and decided to organize the meat cutting operations in Jacksonville, Texas. Walmart responded very quickly by deciding that they were going to sell prepackaged meat at that Walmart store, thus kind of putting all those workers out. Although the NLRB finally came around to saying that Walmart would have to negotiate with those Jacksonville butchers before moving forward with the plans to eliminate the meat cutting department. What's interesting is that there wasn't a mention at all. Now, this is the largest company in America and the world, first time in the United States that a group of Walmart workers was unionized. and there wasn't a mention at all in any of the three major news networks or CNN. There were stories at that same time, if you might remember, about Walmart, about how, and this is kind of a weird connection, about how Walmart really has good connections with the American government, about how the new dollar coin, the Sacagawea coin, was being released through Walmart stores in February 2000. So that got news, but the first group of Walmart workers unionizing ever didn't get news at all. And so that just really shows how it kind of contributes. Now, if people want to organize, yet there's these incredible barriers that are happening on a regular basis at places like Walmart and so many other places, then there's no sense of kind of solidarity or knowing as citizens what's going on. But as consumers, we can find out that, yes, we can get the new dollar at Walmart.
I think the other part of what Chris says is also very important. In his book, he talks about how the leaders of society are framed. And we heard a lot in the 80s and 90s about the entrepreneur and the leaders and so on and so forth, but you would never hear or give the same kind of coverage to the brave souls who actually did that Walmart campaign in Texas from a point of view of our traditional values of independence, of leadership, of sense for democracy. You would think that those people who stood up to what is a very difficult situation would at least get some press. But instead, a value system is promulgated that says, me first, and any sense of solidarity disappears. So it's very hard for people to sort of get positive reinforcement. I suspect if we knew that there had been 6 or 8 or maybe 10 elections in Canada in the last 2 months at Walmart by the union, and it appears they're going to win the one in Quebec this weekend, that would make a difference as to how Walmart workers perceive their situation in Walmart. In fact, that happened, and nobody knows about it.
We're talking to Frank Emspeck, whose voice you just heard, the executive director of the Workers Independent News Service, and also to Chris Martin, the author of the new book, Framed, Labor and the Corporate Media. Today on Media Matters, I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We do have phone lines open if people are interested in calling in and talking about this subject. Questions or comments are welcome. The phone number here is 333-9455, and our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Frank, I think this really leads right into the Workers Independent News Service, because I think, why don't you talk a little bit about that, give some background for our listeners, why you started it and what it does.
Well, we started it as a result of a media conference, the one that preceded yours, here in Madison, and the idea was basically that working people needed a voice in the media to express their concerns about a whole variety of issues, and that there was no such voice. So that's why we started it. And what it is, it's a regular news service, sort of like AP Network News, except it's the Workers' Independent News Service. So we produce every day a 3-minute newscast available to any station in the United States for broadcast, as well as features about once or twice a week that are a little longer, and an economic report designed to counter the 30-second stock market report. As you know, the stock market report is Dow Jones. Ours is called Dow Bob.
And, thank you.
Well, yes, that's why we called it that.
I'm sure.
That's after you, right. And we do that specifically to say when you hear some statistic or whatever on the news or the stock market report, what does it mean for you? So that people have some framework. I think the most striking example of why we need it is what's going on now with the so-called jobless recovery. The very framing of that sentence, jobless recovery. Who is it a recovery for? How can you have a recovery without jobs? And the focus on the stock market as the driver rather than wages or jobs is exactly what Chris is talking about in his book about framing issues. Our job at WINS is to frame the issue in such a way that it reflects the concerns and interests of working people, broadly speaking, and to report on that basis. So it's not biased in that sense. It broadens news coverage, and that's our objective.
Chris, I want to go to the phone lines now. Are you familiar with WINS?
Yes, I am.
And what's your sense of it as a listener?
Oh, I think it's a great service. I mean, I think, as Frank said, it really, provides at least some balance to the overwhelming business orientation that we get in news. It's all about, business and consumers. I get tired of it. I'm with Frank. I want to hear, instead of the stock market going up or down, I want to hear, what's the latest in you know, salaries in America. You know, how's that going up or down? What's the hours worked? How's that go up or down? What's the occupational and safety hazard numbers? Mm-hmm. We just don't get that.
And there's really sort of a worker spin, Frank, isn't there, also on stories that aren't necessarily considered labor stories, things like trade issues?
That's right. We try to make sure that we respond to workers, and we try to interview people, incidentally, at the grassroots. So if we do a Free Trade of the America story, our major objective is to interview a worker someplace in the country and somebody in Mexico so we can hear it from the grassroots, so to speak.
We've got a few callers who are very patient, who are waiting. I want to get to them right now. Let me remind you, the phone number, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455 here at Media Matters. Our guests today, Chris Martin and Frank M. Speck. Line 1, Urbana, you are on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air with Chris Martin and Frank M. Speck.
Thank you. My question is, when does working class become middle class? In Urbana, many, many plumbers make far higher incomes than academics. And I think that this working class denomination is really anachronistic today. What is your view on when does a working class person become middle class?
Okay, well, thank you. Frank, this is a question I suspect you have wrestled with for many years. Why don't you field that one?
I guess it's hard to know. I think part of it, in terms of, is what people do. Are they dependent on somebody else, for their employment? That's one measure that we use as what working class is. We don't use income aggregate so much, which is what you were referring to there. And actually, in the United States, income aggregate became used as the measure of class after World War II, when people started talking about middle class income, as opposed to what people do. So we use the relationship to ownership and relationship, if I can use this terrible old term, to the means of production, as the basic for looking at it. And we try to structure our news to reflect that, which is why we say most people in the United States, whatever their income, not whatever, there's a certain limit, and the 70,000, 80,000, 100,000 gets to be that limit, are what we call workers, or working workers, we would say, not necessarily working class in terms of all their social attributes.
Chris Martin, in the media, do you see the term working class very often?
It's much more used as middle class. And there's this idea, this kind of common sense idea that working class is someone who wears, you know, a blue collar while, you know, she or he does his work, and middle class doesn't. That's not a very accurate portrayal, and I think Frank's, you know, notion of that it's more about the kind of work you do and, you know, whether you're managerial or not. I think that's a much better way of thinking about that. It's interesting being in Iowa right now as the Democratic political candidates kind of talk about this, and I notice some of them, sometimes they use this term working class, but more often they seem to be using the term middle class. And, you know, whichever term you use, there's certainly a divide between working class / middle class and this very, very wealthy managerial class, which has gotten, you know, that's, if there is a recovery, I mean, that's the people who've it's recovered for, because they've done very well, you know, all through the 90s and all the way into 2004. So there's this increasing divide between, you know, people who do the work and people, you know, who manage people.
Okay, let's go back to the phone lines right now. We're talking today on Media Matters with Chris Martin, who you just heard, the author of the new book, Framed, Labor in the Corporate Media, and Frank M. Speck, the executive director of WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. Line 4, Paxton, you're on the air with M. Speck and Martin.
Hi. My question may be somewhat related to the last one. I grew up in a family with many blue-collar union members and realized that really helped me have something growing up. Through the years, I think many of my family members got somewhat disillusioned with the abuse of power within unions. But also, right now, there are two nurses in our family who have absolutely horrendous work conditions in terms of the length of their shifts and not getting breaks. It seems like that whole issue would have enormous implications for the general public who are served by nurses in, you know, at a time of great vulnerability. And I'd like you to speak to that, if you would, and also just the lack of coverage issue on that issue, on that whole situation in particular. And I need to hang up and listen.
Okay, well, thank you. Frank, do you want to go first on that one?
Well, the nurses' unions have been very successful in that. Here in Madison, the nurses' union worked very hard to get a limitation, what we call forced overtime, where people were forced to stay at work after their shift as long as 8 hours. And in California, the California Nurses Association, the Service Employees Union, just were able to force through a limitations on work hours and shift, and insisting, using this issue of quality, that there had to be a certain staffing level. This is a huge victory, and that's what the nurses' unions are trying to do. And again, from our point of view as news people, coverage of those things and showing that not only are the unions trying to be responsive, and the nurses themselves are leading this, that the nurses' unions are trying to be responsive not just for themselves, but for the public, would put a whole light on unions and, in fact, I think be a very useful thing. And I believe that's what Chris and I are sort of worried about, that that simply doesn't happen.
Chris?
Yeah, you know, the idea of nurses and even doctors in unions really kind of breaks up what we were talking about before, about this idea of what's working class or what's middle class, because here, especially with doctors, tend to be much more high income. Yet they're finding the need in recent years to organize as well, particularly when you throw HMOs, which are, you know, very much top-down administration and cost-cutting and kind of labor-quashing oriented organizations. So I think, you know, as Frank mentioned, nurses have been very successful, and they have the same kind of issues that a lot of other occupations have to work with, especially hours. And for nurses, that's a huge thing, because they're, you know, in a really important position of public safety and health.
That's right. They can't leave. And one of the things here is that many nurses don't want to leave. They have this kind of loyalty to the patients, which they should have, and are put in this impossible situation. So the only other party here can be organization, where it isn't just one nurse, where it's many nurses saying, we want quality and decent hours, and that's what's happening.
You know, the caller in her preface to the question made a comment that she grew up in a union family, and that she'd actually grown up surrounded by people who were very critical of unions because of their own experiences in unions, and I assume she meant with corruption or bureaucracy. Frank, from your experience, are these legitimate concerns? I mean, how widespread are these concerns about the quality of unions in the United States?
Well, the concern is pretty widespread. I think there was a poll done by about 2 years ago, and I just saw it actually in Chris's book, as a matter of fact, because I was reading it to make sure we'd be on the same page here today, or at least know what he was talking about. And he's got a poll in there that says that union members polled at about 90% saying they would still want to be in union. So I think the concern is legitimate. There are certainly problems, and to say that there are none is foolish. We know that there are problems, and to the extent that we have a democratic organization, we're able to take care of those problems. But I don't think it's an irrelevant concern. I think it's an important concern. But I also think if you look at coverage, you don't usually see in the newspapers honest people elected a union steward in Madison, Wisconsin. What you'll see in the newspaper is dishonest person steals money.
No,
and that's the man bites dog problem.
Yeah, Chris Martin, to take it the other side of the coin, do you think that business is covered in the same manner as labor? Do you think that I could have a show on the coverage of business in the U.S. news media, and business would complain they only get the bad apples covered as well?
Oh, you know, well, business does complain, certainly. I mean, they always want the most positive coverage. But the way that business tends to get covered when it does something bad, when labor does something bad, it really gets, tarred in a very bad way, I think. And we get the idea of, you know, Jimmy Hoffa becomes synonymous with all labor unions. I mean, I think a lot of people have that sense. For business, it tends to be, the news tends to be more apologetic and kind of saying, well, that's just one bad apple, and if we get rid of that one, or in recent years, several bad apples, then that's okay. But, you know, we don't hear a wholesale indictment of business, even with, the Enron and Global Crossing and Tyco and other scandals that have happened in recent years. In fact, one of the things I kind of, towards the end of the book, kind of talked about that and just noted how the news has tended to be very apologetic about that and saying, well, you know, again, these are just a few kind of outlier cases, and business overall is very good. But, you know, labor tends to get get characterized with a much bigger hand. And you know, so if labor's bad, it's all bad, and we shouldn't trust them.
We're talking to Chris Martin and Frank Emsbach today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a couple phone lines open at 333-9455, or our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air.
Some of the people have kind of approached a couple of the things that I was kind of interested in. One of the lady who talked about the nurses talked, I think, about something that is kind of common in that labor unions are associated with, you know, the trades or something like that. But, and people who consider their jobs more professional and sometimes are, it's almost like we've all, that has been part of the propaganda that, you know, that you're professional, you know, you don't need a labor union kind of relationship. Where I think many of those people do, because the main difference, I think, is, as you have said, between, you know, people who are kind of dependent upon somebody else to frame their workplace experience and people who have their work, you know, who can frame the workplace experience for other people, which should be kind of the distinction between the two groups, and that many of these terms probably are obsolete. You know, those of us who have their workplace experience framed by somebody else need a group to associate with where our interests are presented. And, you know, the other people are obviously, are in the position of power in this experience. Something that I was listening to a lady who was talking about her experience as a teacher in this No Child Left Behind thing and your concept of framing things. And she said that she was basically no longer going to use that term when talking about this law and how it affected her in her school. She was going to give it its generic name, because even just the title was a way to, you know, had framed, and the use of it by media had framed things in a particular way that she thought was very unfair. And that's just my comment. And my question really is, because I didn't get in on the front part of your conversation, is there a place in Champaign at Urbana that is covering your service? And when is it on?
Yeah, Frank?
Well, I'm not sure. I think it's a WEFT. Is that?
That's right. That's the local community station.
Okay. They play Free Speech Radio News, and our material is used there frequently.
Okay.
I don't know what time they play it.
Is there a website folks could go to if they want to link into WINS, independent of a local radio station?
Yep, www.laborradio, two R's there, laborradio.org. And they can listen just by going to their website and pressing a little spot that says listen to the headline news.
Following up on the caller's point, Frank and Chris, realistically, how can, is it possible to see labor movement and workers' interest rejuvenated without much more public awareness of these issues? I mean, they're just covered so in such a limited and distorted manner that most people know all about business and great business entrepreneurs and know almost nothing about labor except sort of what you hear through word of mouth. Is it possible to see the labor movement rejuvenated in this country in this situation?
Well, I can answer that first. In the book, there were a couple of the cases that I looked at from the 1990s where I thought that despite the enormous odds against labor trying to get its case told fairly and framed fairly in the mainstream media, that they were able to do a good job. The two examples actually were the 1997 UPS strike and the 1999 labor protest against the WTO in Seattle. And in the beginnings of those cases, the coverage was pretty much the same. For UPS, as you might expect, it was lots of stories kind of talking about people who didn't get, you know, their lobster grams or wedding dresses or whatever on time because UPS was on strike. But what really threw the mainstream news media kind of into a tizzy, they didn't really know how to deal with it, is that it turned out a few days into the UPS strike that the majority of Americans actually supported the UPS workers. And that was something that they could completely not expected. They just kind of proceed with the assumption that people are going to be against this, and that's, you know, so we're going to talk to the consumers and not to the citizens. But it turned out that there were some really, there were some big successes with UPS. First of all, the workers were very well organized ahead of time, so they had trained all their workers to talk to the press and know the issues. One of the themes of the UPS strike was this idea of a living wage. And that theme really resonated with Americans. A lot of people thought it was just kind of patently unfair that you would have people working side by side at a place like UPS, one of them earning, you know, a higher tier level wage and another one earning a low tier level wage. And that seems unfair to people. And just, it's very simple, and they were very good at getting that message across.
I think it's right there that was a big surprise. But to the question, can labor rejuvenate itself? Well, I think so, at least I hope so. Clearly the news and mutual solidarity and hearing about it is very, very important. So I think it's a question of degree. Unless we have complete and utter 100% censorship in this country, which I suppose is possible, then that's a different story. Other things will have gone down the drain by that time as well. But clearly it would be made easier if people could hear about victories. For example, the largest section of workers that are organized are not steel workers, not automobile workers, but teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all K through 12 teachers in the United States belong to a union, and 250,000 college teachers do. And I think if you asked people, who? They'd say, 250,000 college teachers? You're kidding. Right? So I think that the notion of the media being a real assist here is very, very important. I don't know that it's determinant, but it's certainly important.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Chris Martin and Frank Emspeck.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention first that there's a one-hour show on community radio on Saturdays at 11 o'clock in the morning, which I listen to all the time, and the name of it escapes me at the moment, but so I really appreciate this show, too. But I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned the quality of unions, and recently I saw most of a Merrill report on David Hornbeck's superintendent of schools in Philadelphia and the battles he had with the teacher union there. And, you know, you talk about how the mainstream tends not to put unions in a favorable light, but here's a fellow who's relatively, you know, liberal, and his report wasn't that flattering either, which brings my question about the quality of the unions. On this campus, there's a labor and industrial relations department, and I'm just curious if your guests know whether there's any help coming from academia at all. I mean, like, our labor and industrial relations departments across the country developing at all, or are they stunted or what? Because it seems to me that without you know, good theory and good science, labor movements seem to be kind of doomed every time they come up against these big people with business degrees and MBAs and such. And I'll hang up and listen.
All right, thank you. Well, Frank, you know, before you answer this, and I'll let you feel it since you are in a labor program at the University of Wisconsin,
right,
Extension. There was a long article recently in the Nation magazine on this subject, but go ahead, Frank.
Well, if you take the three largest industrial relations and research programs in the country, as opposed to Extension, which gives practical advice to trade unionists like our division does, but the three of them are either have been abolished or about to be, and those three were the Industrial Relations and Research Institute in Wisconsin, which is finished as of July 1st this year. It's the oldest one in the country, or was. UMass Amherst has major funding crisis, and they're going to get rid of about half of it, if not more. And Governor Schwarzenegger has just abolished the budget by executive action for the Labor Center at the University of California at Berkeley and at UCLA, where they will lose almost all their staff. So if we talk about the stuff on campus, all of those programs are under serious threat. Some have been abolished. None are growing. If we talk about extension, the largest program, one of the largest programs, was in New York State at Cornell. Most of that has been eliminated through budget cuts. And the one of the other larger ones is ours at Wisconsin. We have six people. Out of 17,000 academic staff and faculty, we have six. So maybe five and a half, actually, because of my situation. So the that's the ballpark. So we're certainly not growing, and there's certainly a need to have competent research, education, and analysis going on from that will serve the unions as their primary client, just like you have these massive business schools serving the business community.
Chris Martin, you are a professor at the University of Northern Illinois in Iowa, excuse me. And you, you know, from your experience doing research on labor, are there a lot of people in academia concerned with issues surrounding labor?
You know, not a lot. I'm kind of in a weird location, being in both communication studies, but also you know, trying to connect across with people in history and sociology and in labor programs. But you know, I'm kind of I can only think of maybe like one or two other people in all of communication studies. I mean, hundreds of scholars who even touch labor. So it's kind of an understudied area, which is why I first got into doing this research. I thought, you know, I was just kind of appalled by the lack of study. When there's so much research that's underwritten by grants, oftentimes from business, that really drives the research agenda in a certain way. And, you know, there's not a lot of money or research grants for doing labor research, but it certainly doesn't mean it's not an important area.
Chris Martin, who you just heard, is the author of the new book, Framed: Labor in the Corporate Media. And I can tell you that there are very few books on that subject. And this is an excellent book. I urge people interested in the subject to look up that book, Framed: Labor in the Corporate Media. Let's go back to the phone lines. We have another caller who's been very patient. Line 4, Bimet, you're on the air with Chris Martin and Frank Emspeck.
Yeah, hi. Concerning some of the earlier callers, the Illinois Labor Hour is broadcast every Saturday, except for last Saturday because I was sick.
it's 11 to 12.
At 11, from 11 a.m. till noon, every Saturday morning on WEFT 90.1 FM. And also, too, I believe there is some interest on the WEFT Programming Committee to run Workers' Information News Service.
Oh, and good.
That'll probably come up in some discussions in the future.
Well, call us. You know, we can talk. We'd love to talk to you about it.
Well, we are kind of an anarcho-syndicalist organization, so things go a little slow. But I also believe I was at the conference in Madison.
Yeah, for, you were. You
yeah,
were.
Yeah, this is Bill Grill.
Yes, yes.
But anyway, we invite everybody to tune in, and I'm glad to have this platform to announce it anyway. So y'all have a good rest of the weekend, and good luck in all your endeavors.
All right, well, thank you for calling very much, Bill. Well, you know, guys, well, I've got another 10 minutes or so before we go. One of the themes that we talk a lot about on Media Matters has been the notion of the liberal bias of the news media, which is, I think, a very prominent theme in our news media, ironically, that the media are biased towards liberal and hostile to business and conservative interests. One would imagine if the news media did have liberal bias, it would manifest itself with a hypersensitivity to the concerns of working people and to labor. Chris Martin, how do you deal with the issue when people say to you, come on, Chris Martin, the news media have a liberal bias?
Yeah, that's one of the things I anticipated early on when I started working on this book. What I found is if you look at surveys, and even people who are kind of claiming this liberal bias, if you look at their research, what it really comes down to is that they're basing the liberal bias on certain kind of social issues. So like, you know, positions on, you know, for example, feminism or abortion or things like that. When you get into the realm of, and that may or may not be so, but when you get into the realm of economic issues, it's very clear that they don't have any kind of data or support to back up that kind of claim. And actually, if you look at surveys of the presumed elite kind of, you know, Northeastern journalist, what you find out is that, you know, even though they might, you know, be members of the Democratic Party predominantly, when you look at their actual kind of economic beliefs, they tend to be very conservative. They tend to be very supportive of capitalism, tend to be very supportive of of kind of unfettered capitalism, I should say, and not supportive at all of labor. So when you look at it you could make a really easy argument for a very conservative bias, at least in economic terms, in the news. So that doesn't hold water at all with me. And if you look at the evidence, it's just not there.
Frank M. Speck, journalists are, I think, by your criteria, for the most part, workers. They work for a living. They work for someone else who owns the company. They do not own the company. And one would imagine there might be some sensitivity or sympathy then for the plight or the concerns or interests of other workers as well. What's the story there? Are journalists, are they represented by unions?
Less and less so. The Newspaper Guild represents many people, and one of the founding, Hayward Bruin, when he founded the Newspaper Guild, made a point that the Newspaper Guild is the defender of democracy in the newsroom, and that the Newspaper Guild will defend reporters doing their job as reporters. And I think what we've seen with the Newspaper Guild in the last few years is a vigorous defense of that, but often not successful, where major dailies have broken the unions and have deunionized the place. So there's that going on. I just wanted to say one thing about what Chris said. I agree completely with his assessment that when you look at the social issues, it's one thing. When you look at the economic issues, it's another. Now, in terms of actual working press, we have, that is, the Workers' Independent News Service, is in the process of developing much stronger links with the working press, particularly the print press, who are the primary members of the Newspaper Guild, to see if we can begin to talk about a rejuvenation or a deeper look at some of the economic issues that the men and women have to report over. There's also a class change, incidentally, in the people who are reporters. If you look at 50 years ago, many of the reporters had never been to college and came from working class or skilled trades backgrounds. And say, after World War II, in particular in the last 30 years, you had to go to a journalism school to get a job as a reporter. And so there was a social change in the composition of the reporting workforce, I think, which sort of took them away or increased the distance, social distance, between the reporter and the audience that they were covering.
You know, Frank, there's the urban legend you might be familiar with that in 1929, when the stock market crashed, the reporters in the Boston Globe newsroom stood up and gave the stock market crash a standing ovation because they were so excited that the bosses of the 1920s were getting their comeuppance.
Yeah, I mean, I could believe that.
And then, to finish the story, then in 1987, when the stock market crashed again, the same newsroom floor, the reporters were all on the phone to their brokers, frantically trying to cover their investments.
Well, they could have done it then. Now, one of the interesting things is that for news reporters starting out, like my son tried to, you're talking about wages where you're eligible for food stamps.
Hmm. Well, we've only got a few minutes left, and we've got a couple of very patient callers. Let's get back to the phone lines. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Chris Martin and Frank M. Speck.
Hi. I wanted to go back to the Staley battle and how it wasn't reported, and you gave the very interesting comparison to, you know, the concurrent struggle for the ballplayers union. But the other thing that shows that we don't have a press that's in any way liberal is, if you look at what was at stake at that strike, was really the 40-hour work week. People over there now are working 3 days on, 3 days off, 12-hour shifts, which means that they don't have a weekend really either, which was another product of the labor struggle. So it just I just wanted you to return to that, actually, and just make that point that this kind of race to the bottom under the radar thing that it should be something that would have attracted people to the issue, but it certainly didn't. But because maybe I guess they were investing in Bungie Long or Lyle and Tate or whatever the company was at the time in the newsrooms instead of reporting what the implications have been for working people. You know, there are other factories in Decatur now that are also on this absolutely horrendous shift. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the comment. And that story was certainly missed altogether in the press coverage. Let's go back to the phone lines for our last caller. Line two, Champagne, you're on the air with Chris Martin and Frank M. Speck.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
One thing I've never heard anybody mention, starting back with the savings and loan scandal many years ago, the public coffers have paid out hundreds of billions of dollars, literally, to bail out things like the savings and loan. And we continue to. We don't know where the money really goes because it's sort of disappears. I think it disappears into the very wealthy. And we're in the midst of actually two going on right now. Never gets reported, never gets mentioned.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call. We've only got a minute left, so I want to get the guest a chance to respond to that. Frank, coverage of tax issues. How does WINS cover the Bush tax cuts different from the mainstream news media?
We take a look at who they affect specifically, and we try to take this pretty complex subject, get a coherent tax expert, and then usually we cover taxes actually about twice a week in our headline and usually a feature every 2 weeks. And we try to say, what is the effect? Is it really true there's an economic multiplier effect for tax cuts for the rich? Is it really true that there's a middle-class tax cut? What does the actual language say, and who is affected? We try to be very clear and specific. We don't editorialize about it. We just try to describe it.
And in issues of sort of subsidies, like bailouts, like the savings and loan, does WINS have a way to cover that that's different from the other news media?
Well, again, we talk about it in reality. We take a look at exactly who is benefiting and who is not. If we take a look at the Enron scandal, for instance, which we did a lot of coverage of, we said, are the workers who work for Enron getting paid? Who has got them? Who's carrying the? Who's holding the bag here? And we look at it from that point of view. As opposed to the bondholders' point of view, because they did get paid.
Mm-hmm. Chris Martin, we've only got about 30 seconds, 45 seconds left. Any closing comments you'd like to make?
Yeah, one thing I think I just needed to emphasize is that, you know, even for reporters who try to do a good job in covering labor issues, what they're locked in is a system where they're working for corporations that have this corporate viewpoint, and that and it's really hard to operate in a way that doesn't reflect those corporate views. I mean, there's very subtle pressure, sometimes direct, but usually not direct, but you just kind of cue to that organizational ideology and kind of reflect that. So that's why we don't hear a lot about labor issues, because those same corporations, you know, Disney or Viacom or GE, have those same kind of labor problems throughout their entire corporation. They see them as problems, and they see, you know, that we shouldn't be reporting positively on labor issues.
Chris Martin, the author of the new book, Framed, Labor in the Corporate Media, a great book I urge our listeners to check out. Chris, I want to thank you very much for being my guest today.
Thank you.
Frank Emspach, the executive director of the Workers' Independent News Service and a true warrior for social justice in this country. Frank, thank you so much for joining me today.
And thank you, Bob.
It's been a pleasure having you. I'm Bob McChesney, the host for Media Matters. I'll be back next week with another show. Upcoming shows, we've got Paul Krugman, Robert Poland, and Al Franken, so stay tuned. I want to thank Victor Picard, as always, for being a terrific producer, and I'll join you in 167 hours. Adios.
Hi, I'm meteorologist Ed Keezer, reminding you that the same weather team you rely on during the day on AM 580 brings you accurate, in-depth weather at night on WILL-TV. Be more prepared. Watch your weather weeknights at 9:58 on our companion station, WILL-TV. This is the Information Advantage, WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the University of Illinois.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny, breezy, and warmer, the high in the mid-40s, with southwest winds 15 to 25 miles per hour, with gusts around 35 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy and brisk, with a chance of flurries, the low around 30 degrees, with west winds 15 to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, with the high in the lower 40s, and west winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. It's 2 p.m. Central Time, a Prairie Home